Candy.
What's candy?
This is candy candy, isn't it?
Yeah, it's fruit candy.
Oh, God.
I'm going to give it a go.
Local Malaysian fruit candy.
Definitely give it a go.
Yeah, where did this come from? Thanks.
So
picked
we
it
trek out and like, James, fall down a lot right? and get candy.
It's from a local
durian.
Malaysian fruit, durian, yeah.
But isn't that the crazy, like really smelly stuff?
No. Are you ridiculous?
Is this actually disgusting?
You're making us
eat it?
No, it's really tasty.
Is that actually?
It's really good. I like
it. Like you never eat that.
Oh my God. Oh my God. Oh my God. Oh my God.
Oh no.
Oh my God.
Are you serious?
That is
you
are properly wrong. You such a dick.
What is it?
No
what
beam.
Is it?
It's a fruit. The fruit pie. Like it's
oh!
A
oh! Get off my tongue.
So welcome to Rally Borneo 13K. Or should I say, what the hell just happened? So on this podcast, I'm going to recount my journey on Rally. Amongst the jokes and the silliness, which there is a lot of, I'll touch on why Rally is in Borneo, a rundown of what I got up to in my projects, warts and all, and finally some soppy stuff on how I developed as a project manager. And hopefully, you'll get inspired to do something similar, because honestly, it's going to be up there with the best times of your life. So just what is Rally? And where is Borneo for that matter? So Rally is a youth and sustainable development charity, which basically throws young adults, known as venturers, into remote areas to do sustainable development work. And for many, it's their first time away from home. I was a project manager, one of about 20, and tasked with basically achieving three things. One, making sure the projects got finished on time. Two, ensuring health and safety standards were adhered to. And three, helping the venturers from a personal development perspective. And where is Borneo? Okay, so imagine Thailand. Now head south until you get to the tip of that landmass, and on your right is a gigantic circular island. You can't miss it. It's also owned by three countries, Malaysia, Indonesia, and Brunei. And Rally operates in Sabah, which is the poorest state of Malaysia. It all began in September, when the project managers arrived and spent 2 weeks in intensive training. It was a golden period where food was plentiful and alcohol permitted. We learned how to destroy local parks while putting up radio kits, how to inject oranges with out-of-date vaccines, and we visited our project sites to try to comprehend what the bloody hell we were going to do in 2 weeks.
Dumb ways to die, so many dumb ways to die. Dumb ways to die.
So a few nights before the venturers arrived, we hit up a local karaoke bar. Now, I'm going to use this segment to present the three more senior members of the management team, based purely on their musical performances. But be warned, by continuing to listen to this podcast, you hereby consent to not sue the author, his immediate family, and or any of his illegitimate children for any psychological or physiological distress. And so I present you Mac, country director, with a rendition of The Human League's Don't You Want Me, sung in a completely different key from the karaoke backing music. I now present Philly, country program manager, performing at a rate of 93 BPM, by which I mean bob per minute and not beats. And finally Chris, deputy program manager, with a style of dance best described as a man fighting off a horde of angry, irate chickens. If you want to hear more of Mac, Philly and Chris's singing and dancing skills, just send them an email. It's a little known fact that they also do children's birthday parties and corporate award ceremonies. Right, now let's actually turn to the projects I got involved in on Rally. So my first project was installing two gravity water feeds in a very remote community in Sabah called Sonsogon Suyad. Now, what do I mean by remote?
About 3 to 4 hours drive from Kota Marudu. If it rains, it's probably about a 10-hour drive.
According to the World Bank, as of 2011, Malaysia had 100% access to improved water sources. But Sonsogon Suyad and many villages like it are relatively marginalised communities, largely forgotten by the rest of the country, except where their timber is concerned. And Sonsogon Suyad's lack of access to water was a mere rounding error for the Malaysian Statistics Office. Sonsogon Suyad was one of the most beautiful villages I've ever seen, perched on top of a rolling mountain range, with Mount Kinabalu, the tallest mountain in Sabah, just off in the distance. The village had a very small number of inhabitants, and it shifted about all the time. Before the year 2000, the village was a lot larger, as villagers were employed by logging companies. But logging the local forests has not come to an end, and little money ever really made it back into the hands of the communities. They were mostly compensated for logging their ancestral forests with physical goods, food, perhaps a hut. While we couldn't tell for sure, it seemed like they never really got their fair share. But despite not building any proper roads to the village, nor providing water, the government was not completely neglecting the needs of the village. For many years, the government has provided a flying doctor service, which reaches remote villages once a month. It landed next to our community hut one day, and I took the chance to talk to the pilot and doctor. Although this is a much appreciated service, there were still some limitations, as the doctor pointed out.
One flight costs around 5 to 10k.
5 to 10,000 ringgit, that's about 2,000 pounds for a single flight.
They have to improvise further, because any cases that we need to refer, we cannot do. We just give some simple symptomatic treatment only.
Symptomatic treatment, yeah.
So that's quite, I feel bad, because I cannot give more, because I wanted to give more.
So try to imagine what it might feel like not to have ready access to water. Well, we experienced this firsthand for 2 weeks. Before the dam was built, we had to carry our own water from a local river. And here's one venture's taken it.
So first we had a 25-litre jerry can. And to be honest, I didn't really realise what 25 kilograms are like, because I never carried 25 kilograms before. And it was really tough. Like, after 1 minute, I had to have a break.
How long was the entire journey?
So normally without any water, it takes about 20, 25 minutes, I think. Mm-hmm. And with the water, it took much longer.
Yes. How far does 25 litres go?
Maybe one morning. It doesn't go very far. Yeah. And imagining having to do this every single day for the rest of your life, it's crazy. And it really made me appreciate having running water. And like, after carrying the water here, I was very, very careful about how much water I use for daily stuff. If I use too much water when washing my hands, I'll have to go over there and get more water, which is going to be really hard. Or we didn't really shower. We went to the river, so we didn't use any water for washing ourselves. It was a special day when you could actually wash your clothes.
For 3 weeks, we lived in a little community hut, sleeping right up against one another on a hard wooden floor. The hut was perched on top of a mountain and was completely exposed to the elements, which meant that when it rained, you knew about it.
Oh yes, we had several storms and a lot of water before we even got water into the village. That was our shower.
Try and picture this. Looking out over the vast mountain ranges extending far out in the distance, you could see the curtain of rain slowly advancing towards us, and then you'd hear the thunder. And then the heavens would open.
Boom!
We had a large tarp overhanging the community hut, which was completely lifted off.
It's lifting off.
Dragging stakes of wood with it.
Oh God!
Whoa!
One of our many challenges was integrating with the local villagers. One day, I heard the music of a single gong in the distance. I grabbed a microphone, ran down, and began recording. And it turns out it was a main melodic instrument of a gong orchestra. And before long, we found ourselves invited to a local child's birthday party and listening to the full rendition. I even had to turn on the main melodic gongs. It was wonderfully hypnotic jamming away. But while this was going on, the venturers saw a less flattering side of the villagers.
So you were quite popular today. Why? What happened?
There was one particular young man who decided I was his favourite, apparently. So I had some paparazzi.
Yeah. Do you feel you indulged him in any way?
I do not. Yeah. Well, I didn't really want to get vomit on myself, so I decided...
Vomit? Why vomit?
He had thrown up over himself.
When?
So he threw up out the window.
Really?
Yeah, he did.
Why?
And afterwards, he threw up on the floor. And then he passed out.
Was he drunk?
Yes, he was extremely drunk.
They were all like completely wasted.
Yeah. They were all so drunk.
For any reason, I don't know.
We hauled kilos of sand, cement, and materials up a very slippery river path over the course of 2 weeks, and we got the gravity water feeds completed in time. It was a very special day when we turned on the taps for the first time. For some of the venturers, it was their best moment on rally.
Best moment is when we already finished the water gravity feed. That's the best moment, because everyone is happy and everyone appreciates water that time.
Although on that day, one of the really exciting parts of it is that when they actually opened the pipe from the dam, you could hear the air dispersion in the pipe. And then eventually the sound of water, which was really, really cool.
Once we'd finished the project, we celebrated in the afternoon with the villagers playing games. We were really happy to have completed the project, but we did wonder what the future of the village looked like. I mean, how will ready access to water affect a village? Will the village begin growing again and become more like its richer neighbouring villages? One venturer had a very interesting perspective, basically saying that even with water, the village couldn't offer much else, so why would the villagers emigrate back to it?
Well, you lose a lot of time if you have to collect water every day, and it takes you an hour every day.
What do you think they're going to do with this, the time they've saved?
I don't think they're going to do big things. They have water, so it makes their lives here a lot more easy, but they're still really remote.
So do you feel that what we've done with the water pipes is worthwhile?
Yes, I think for these people, I mean, it makes life so much easier for them. I don't know, maybe more people will come back.
Yeah, maybe.
But I'm not sure, because, I mean, if you live in a city, you have water and electricity and, I don't know, everything.
Yeah. Basically what you're saying is that there's nothing the village can offer here, which the city cannot offer.
No.
Except for strong family ties.
Yes.
And, you know, cultural kind of...
Sort of...
Ties, you know.
Sort of feeling.
But I had conversations with people more familiar with the principles behind development work later on, and they said that providing water was our sole goal. People have chosen to live in Sonsogon Suyad, and they don't have water, so they have a right to water. Job done. As outsiders, we shouldn't make judgments on whether it is worth installing water infrastructure based on the future of the village. The villagers are the only people who should determine their own future. As a PM team, we had no experience in youth management or even project management for community infrastructure. We basically had to learn on our feet.
There are loads of elements that were quite testing. For me, I think the most testing element was actually from the team and trying to find our feet as PMs, really, trying to find out where we would stand within the team, whether we should be managing them directly, how much we should be allowing it to themselves. I mean, we were finding our feet, and there's only one way to find out, is through experience.
And we all experimented with different styles. So I decided to throw myself in amongst adventurers. I figured, surely everyone knows I'm a project manager, so why act aloof and attempt to distance myself? And the adventurers loved the fact that I joked around and organised entertainment in the evening.
Okay, I think you have done it very well.
Okay.
Because during the evenings, you brought some entertainment, and that was very important, because sometimes I really like to do something.
Yeah.
That was good.
And through playing cards, you've really bonded with the group well. Even though you're really shit at poker.
You lost fair and square. Let's not revisit that.
Yeah, it's just the stuff like that, which, like, I think makes a lot of difference to how the venturers see you, like having that personal connection.
But I realised I'd crossed the line just a bit, because there were instances when they sometimes forgot I was a PM in the first place.
You don't feel like the distance between, like, I'm a PM, you're a venturer, which is really nice. But that can maybe also have a downside, because sometimes there are times that a PM has to step up and be like, no, this is not possible. And then it's sometimes kind of weird when at the one side you're like at the same level, and then suddenly you have to be like...
Become something someone different.
Yeah.
And the other PMs had their frustrations too.
Phase one, you were difficult because you became a venturer. But then Angela and I were trying to sort of retain some sort of rallyism, and then that was kind of to our fault as well. There's no kind of middle ground, so unfortunately we became distanced from the group, and then they absolutely loved you.
On the back of the feedback, I made a conscious effort to not lose the position of authority while still remaining very approachable. And it was a tightrope that I walked better from then on. My next project was at Danum Valley, one of the oldest rainforests in the world. Our task there was to fix a suspension bridge. Raleigh provides huge scope for doing really great things for vulnerable communities, learning about yourself, and really having a good time. But it's dangerous work. I mean, Raleigh works in remote areas, miles away from hospitals and even cell phone reception. And sometimes things go wrong. And the consequences can be devastating. I mean, serious injuries are not uncommon, and sadly, people have died on expeditions before. There is one day in Danum Valley which will remain with me for a long time. We had finished for the day at the bridge site. It was a long, hot day of really tough work. The work site was an hour's trek away through the rainforest. And during the trek back, a venturer complained of dizziness and, soon after, began to collapse. The PMs were at the back of the group with the fading venturer, along with two other venturers. But the majority of the venturers had gone ahead and hadn't stopped to wait for us. They had the satellite phone and radio kit, our only forms of communication, and the emergency stretcher. We had left the worksite much later than usual that day, and darkness was slowly descending, and we didn't have any torches. Here's how the PMs remember that day.
I think it was probably one of the worst experiences in my life so far. I think the thing that I really struggled with is that the venture was entirely our responsibility and under our care.
Actually, splitting the team was another kind of a scary moment, because it's like it was at least six of us there, but then when we split, it was only three left, and I felt like really vulnerable at that point.
And this was about 5:30, so it was beginning to get actually the light was fading very fast at this point.
Yeah,
the light was fading.
And what do you remember about helping the venturer through the jungle?
Oh no, that was really bad. One thing is that it was difficult to like squeeze in that narrow pass, carrying another person on your shoulder, so it was sliding all the way down the path. And the other thing is that the venturer was constantly passing out.
It took a lot of mental strength to keep talking to him, to try and keep getting him engaged with you, saying his name, getting him to at least concentrate or something. So what we used, if I was walking in front, was my shoes as a point for him to concentrate on, so I couldn't walk too far ahead, and then he had something to aim for. But what was really distressing at that point is that the only thing that he could say by that point was shoes.
So he'd just be like kind of stumbling along saying shoes.
Yeah. And then his head would just drop.
Tune in to part 2 to learn what happened and how we dealt with the aftermath.